Things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, September the 3rd, 2026, and we are up to episode 3,894 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Thursday. That means you know what? It is time for the Expert Council Q&A for Q&A show of the week. Yep, it is the big show, the one where we have all of the experts. Well, we have a segment of the experts answer your questions. I do need more fodder for content for the expert panel. I've shaken the piker tree pretty hard. We've gotten through the meat of summer anyway, and it is time to start ramping up the content going into fall. So I need your questions for expert panel members. You can go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, and under the About tab, you will find Meet the Expert Council. You can see all the experts there and what they can answer for you. On that, though, if you don't know who to ask, just send me the question, say it's for the expert panel, and I'll pick somebody for you, because we probably have someone that covers it. TSPC expert in the subject line. Ask your question in a single sentence. I promise you, you can do it. If you have more than one question, send more than one email. It'll work better that way, I promise you, even if we're the same expert. Then hit return a couple times, and then give me your details, and I will get you an answer, as long as they don't pike on me. And they're all pretty damn good about not piking on me. And you know who I need questions for? Nicole Sauce. I haven't had any questions from Nicole for a while, so I really need some Nicole Sauce questions. All right, who do I have today, though? I have Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini. And the question is Trump going to arm the Iranians, since he keeps telling them to rise up against their own government and they're basically a disarmed population? Or is he serious at this point about the Iranian people like taking over against the IRGC? Is that even possible? Well, Dr. Paul and Chris will talk about that. Jesse Markowitz will talk about understanding the cold card debacle. I did cover that back when it first happened, but Jesse has his own perspective on it. I think it's still an important topic to understand. We also have a question that's going to be handled by Patrick Roman on choosing a good budget tomahawk. He has three recommendations you can check out for budget tomahawks. I have one that sits somewhere in the middle of the stuff he recommends. He's got two really budget-friendly ones, one a little bit more expensive. I got one that kind of sits between the two lower cost and the one upper cost. But, you know, we have the same manufacturer we're recommending on that lower end. And so we'll talk all about that. Then Ryan Steva will talk about a rapid shutdown system for a photovoltaic solar power system. Specifically, what is it? How does it work? When do you need one? And when do you not need one? And then last, I'm going to talk to you guys just a little bit about like lifestyle design philosophy going forward today. And basically, my segment is titled Specialization is a Trap, Why 2026 Belongs to Polymaths. And I have always advocated, you know, becoming a polymath. And I've always tried to explain to people that, like, when you say you're a polymath, it doesn't mean you have to be equivalent to, like, the well-known historical examples like Leonardo da Vinci or something like that. You don't necessarily have to be a great artist. It means to be good at a great many things. And I think it also has, it really conveys to be great at least a few things. Or Benjamin Franklin, very well known for a lot of his sayings, and Poor Richard's Almanac, His statement was a jack of all trades and a master of none. And I modified that in my life to be a jack of all trades. I get to be a jack because I am jack. A jack of all trades and a master of some. I think it does make sense to actually become a master and develop mastery at certain things. But you have to do it in a fluid way so that if you need to pivot your primary focus, you can utilize that mastery no matter where you go. And so I'm going to be talking about that because I think that, like, this is important if you're 55 right now to think about this way. But if you're 15, like my grandson, oh my God, you better think this way. The biggest decade of flux that any human has ever seen will be between the years 2025 and 2035, Jack Spirko. We are there. It's 2026. It's happening. We're watching it happen right now, and it's accelerating. And you know, just on the AI front, I'm seeing it daily. As I work with AI, I am seeing the improvement that I think most people would be imperceptible to. It's not just me getting better at using it. It's getting better at being used. It's pretty amazing. And it's only one part of this. So, you know, we're going to talk about how that fits. And that's really what this show is. Like, it would have never marketed well if I called it that. But I could have called this the Lifestyle Design and Polymath Podcast. Right. Or even just the Polymath Podcast kind of rolls off the tongue in a weird sort of clunky way. Right. Like, because if you think about what we cover, we've covered everything. Aquaponics, homesteading, biochar, composting, entrepreneurship, investing, Bitcoin, technology, artificial intelligence, you know, basic preparedness, advanced preparedness, dealing with fires. Like, what have we not covered in our 18 years? And the answer is we've covered pretty much everything. So let's get on into it. Before we do, I want to remind you, though, about the TSP 2026 workshop here at my place on Nine Mile Farm. If you want to come here, meet me, learn a lot, and meet some of the coolest people you will ever meet, and have what can only be described as a 3.5-day party that somehow is also educational, then you want to come for that. We charge $600 for it, $200 deposit on the day the tickets go on sale. They usually sell out the same day. They usually sell out within about 10 minutes. I don't know if that'll happen. Sometimes we sell out in 10 minutes. Sometimes we sell out in 10 hours. You just don't know. And so don't risk it if you want to come. $200 to reserve your spot, $400 when you get here. The workshop dates are going to be November 11 through 15. We have some really new, unique things going on this year. More stuff will come on Monday about that, so we don't spend too much time in the intro here. Let's come on and drop into it. Let's hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on, you know, is Trump serious when he's telling the people of Iran, who are completely disarmed people, rise up against your government, who is armed to the teeth? I don't know. Let's see what Dr. Paul and Chris think about that.
Our government started this war. It's our government that stirred the pot again today, yesterday. And that's so disappointing to me that happens. But that happens to be the truth. And I thought, but I'm an optimist. What am I going to do with this today? Maybe it can be turned around. Maybe this loss of credibility by our administration, you know, on again, off again, and all the exaggerations and all the stuff we listen to, maybe it's not all bad. Maybe that'll be an initiative for converting a few more people to at least think about our side. Chris, that's what I think is important. Chris?
That's right, Dr. Paul. I have so many questions. Why is the U.S. attacking what Trump calls a failed state with no military, who don't know who their leader is, and then has lost so many times over they've lost? Why does the U.S. keep attacking them? And why does this failed state with no military, they don't know who their leader is, and that has lost, why do they keep fighting back and inflicting all this damage? You know, and why is President Trump asking the Iranian people to rise up when regime changes? Clearly, no, the goal was never regime change after it failed, of course. Why are you asking the Iranian people to rise up and fight? And why do you think that the Iranian people would rise up and fight when you have threatened to abolish their civilization, their power plants? You've bombed the schools that killed 160 schoolgirls, and just yesterday you hit a wedding. Why would the Iranian people rise up and help you? These are questions. You know, if we control the Strait, let's play along 100%. Let's say we control the Strait. Why is Besant saying that in 2 years that Strait is going to be obsolete? So we control this Strait in order to make it obsolete? Obviously, I'm pointing out all of these absurdities, and why do the American people have to put up with this? You know, during the Biden administration, it was all over X, Twitter, whatever it was back then. Your government hates you. The government hates you. Biden, yeah. You know, they're trying to tell us that there's no difference between a man and a woman, and men can get pregnant. Yeah, that's not somebody that's on your side. But how can we come to any different conclusion with this government when it's lies from start to present? Total lies. How could they not hate us by doing all this stuff?
So this is where I agree, but I have a different take. I'm sure many people in Iran hate us right now. And I'm sure many people that are like the common everyday person in Iran have hatred for us right now. I think many of those people have a much larger hatred for their own government, who has been in their face and doing the shit that they do over there for 50 years almost now. Okay? Like, I really believe that. I do think there's a huge undertone of people in Iran that feel that they are completely oppressed by a government that is run by a mafia organization. The IRGC is a bunch of mafia thugs. They really are. And there's no way around that. And I know we have corruption in this country too. And I'm not here to do a comparison or a whataboutism. I'm saying it is so over the top. Imagine the corruption of places like Los Angeles and Chicago, right? But then the people with the corruption have, you know, the armament of the Iranian military. And there's nowhere to go from there. You can't get away from it. You're stuck there. That's what Iran has. So do I think that the people of Iran could be compelled to rise up? Yes. Do I think they'll do it? No, because I don't believe they have any belief that they have any chance for success. I don't think it's because they hate us. Because even if they hate us, they hate the people that are directly oppressing them and have been, and have been dragging them into the streets and shooting them in the head for, what, 4.5 decades more than they hate us. They absolutely do. So, I don't know. What I found really stupid about this whole topic, and I've heard several reporters ask the Orange Man this, is, are you going to use the CIA to arm the people? What a stupid question. You know why it's stupid? Because you don't want to say you're not. And you don't want to say you are. There's no good answer to that question. That's why reporters ask questions like that. They ask stupid questions. And it's not Trump. And it's not new. I remember all the way back in 1990 when we were getting ready to go into Iraq. And I remember reporters asking Bush Sr., along with some of his staff, question, you know, the generals and shit, like, well, exactly when and how do you plan to invade Iraq? You know, they have a really big military. How do you plan to do it? Are you going to use this unit? Are you going to use that? Shut up! Now, if I have to explain to you why this is stupid, I don't know that you'll understand it, but the reason this is stupid is because you don't tell the enemy what you're going to do before you do it. So I think the whole thing's a mess, and I've said this before. I would have never done it, but if I had to do it, you know, let's say I'm Trump and he knows something I don't know, and they really were going to get a nuclear weapon in 2 weeks like they've been going to do for 20 years. There's like one way or another you convince me to do it. Oh, I'm doing it. This would be done by now if I'm doing it. If you are not willing to eliminate every asset an enemy has, don't go to war with them. Period. Now, I know somebody's going to be right now, yeah, you're said to be a libertarian and an anarchist, and you're a warmonger, and you... Stop it. Stop it. Just stop that shit. I said I wouldn't do it. But if you're going to do it, then do it and get it done. Here's an example. And it doesn't involve killing a bunch of people. Iran is able to do what they do primarily because of their radar technology. They have these massive radar arrays that are inland from the coast about 15 miles-ish. They look like giant antennas that we used to use for television back in the 70s. If you're old enough to remember, the one you had to go out and turn with a pipe wrench while your dad yelled at you like I did, like that. But they are massive. They ain't hard to hit and they don't move. You knock those out, a lot of this shit where they're shooting rockets and missiles and stuff at the ships in the strait, they can't see it, they can't shoot at it. They can only go line of sight then. And I know the strait looks really, really tiny on your TV set, but it doesn't work that way. It's a lot wider than you think it is, especially as they take the southern route near the coast of Oman. Then you're having to send out forward observers to make, you know, call back on radio, like all kinds of ways to end up dead. Why are they able to see anything? So this is not their power plants, their missiles. You see what I'm saying? There are so many ways that these people, without spending more money, Use the stuff we already blew up. Some of the stuff we blow up, it doesn't have much of an effect. Redirect that. Cripple the infrastructure. Cripple the ability to bring anything into the country. There should be no railroads and no roads bringing anything into that country right now from outside. There should be no marine being delivered anywhere. The only thing left is the airport, and you put enough potholes in the runway, the plane can't land. Now, again, I'm not advocating this. Either do it and do it right and get it done, or don't do it. That's a military assessment, right? That's not a philosophical. Because my first statement is what? Don't touch it. Well, all we had to do was leave it alone. Now it's a hornet's nest. And no one's willing to do what's necessary to get rid of the hornets. Let's move on to something a little more practical. Let's talk with Jesse about the cold card event.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from David. David asks what I think about the recent cold card debacle and how we can avoid similar mistakes with hardware devices in the future. He also asks about passphrases, checking seed generation, and using dice to generate a seed. First, a quick summary. Cold Card is a Bitcoin hardware wallet that had been highly respected. In late July, they disclosed that in some of their firmware, seed phrases came from a much smaller pool of randomness than intended. The words looked random, and the wallet worked normally, but attackers could search that reduced space, recreate vulnerable seeds, derive the private keys, and steal the Bitcoin controlled by them. To be clear, Bitcoin was not hacked. A particular wallet implementation failed to generate strong seed phrases. If your seed phrase is weak, putting that same seed phrase into a different hardware wallet does not help. The weakness is in the seed, not the device. So the fix is straightforward. Generate a completely new seed with strong randomness for a new wallet and send your Bitcoin from the old wallet to the new one. One way to add protection beyond the seed phrase is a passphrase. This is an additional secret combined with your seed phrase to create a different wallet. A strong passphrase can provide significant additional protection. David specifically asks about using a passphrase that isn't random, but has unpredictable upper and lowercase letters. The purpose of the passphrase is to give an attacker another secret to guess. Dictionary words or familiar phrases, even with unusual capitalization, do not add as much protection as you might think. If you're going to use a passphrase, make it genuinely strong and hard to guess. Be aware that this adds security, but also adds complexity. You now need both your seed phrase and your passphrase. With self-custody, if you lose either one, you may lose access to your Bitcoin. David also asks, how do you know whether a hardware wallet generated a good seed? You generally can't tell by looking at the seed phrase. It's like looking at one roll of a pair of dice and trying to determine whether the dice themselves are fair. You need confidence that the large amount of randomness required was really there when the seed was generated. One way to improve that confidence is to combine randomness from multiple independent sources. For example, the hardware wallet plus entropy from a computer, phone, dice, or coin flips. But any time code takes that entropy and turns it into a seed phrase, you also need confidence that the code being executed is correct and isn't making a mistake in that process. This is where open source software can help. You may not personally audit every line, but other people can, and security researchers are strongly incentivized to find exactly these kinds of mistakes. Finally, the dice question. Yes, this is a good way to generate randomness. It takes about 100 fair independent dice rolls to provide enough randomness for a 24-word seed. A few cautions. People are not good at generating randomness. If you just pick numbers instead of actually rolling the dice, there's a good chance you'll introduce some pattern. Also, the sequence of your dice rolls contains the information used to generate your seed, which ultimately controls your private keys. So keep it secret. Don't put it in a website, photo, cloud note, or AI chat. And use a documented process to turn those rolls into a seed. Now, what do I think of the cold card debacle? I feel very bad for the people who lost Bitcoin because of this. Cold card had a solid reputation before this incident, and I suspect the nature of this failure will make it hard for many people to trust cold card again, even though they've released updated firmware that fixes future seed generation. For me, the bigger lesson is the danger of a single point of failure and the responsibility that comes with self-custody. When you self-custody, you take responsibility for the whole custody setup. That means understanding where your randomness comes from, how your seed is generated, what firmware you're running, how your backups work, and whether you've tested recovery. One final note, as this incident has shown, sometimes there may be a problem with a single key system. One approach is to use multiple signatures, multi-sig, perhaps requiring two of three keys to sign, and diversify the hardware used. So maybe a Trezor, a seed signer, and a Jade. This way, even if one key is compromised or turns out to be much weaker than expected, an attacker would still need to compromise another key before they could get at your Bitcoin. Multi-sig adds complexity, so it isn't right for everyone, but for larger holdings, it is definitely worth considering. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. David, thanks for the questions. For more of my thoughts on Bitcoin, I have a new Bitcoin Pivot podcast every week at thebitcoinpivot.com/podcasts. And if you want help with StartOS, Bitcoin risk assessments, or other technology questions, please just reach out.
So my additions here are, number one, I think the problem we got out of the cold card debacle, if you want to call it that, is that it created an undue amount of panic among people because it was supposedly so secure, and it was supposedly so secure because it was a completely air-gapped device, which actually leads to why it became a compromised device. Though it was a only a certain window of cold cards that had the problem, and some had it worse than others and were more susceptible than others. If you're using any cold card device, still, I would get your money off of it. I don't care when it's from or what they say. I would not trust people that made that mistake with my money ever again. Okay. But the reality is that the device itself caused the problem in the generation of the seed that made the seed not as random as we thought. And it is because there was a kind of a fallback loop in the code. So it was supposed to generate a random number, which can be backed up then, which is basically a phrase, right? So when you have that phrase and it's like dog, elephant, auto, car, monkey, dog poop, whatever the words are, those words actually represent numbers, right? That's what they really are. And so what happened with that device was the true random number generator failed, so it defaulted to a pseudo random number generator. And that's like, that sounds like a conspiracy, but what it really is there's a lot of processing in your computer that needs random generation, but it doesn't need to be super secure. You know, it might be something like a moving screensaver needs some randomness added to it so it doesn't look like a pattern. Just something that simple. So there is this pseudo random number generator, which sort of kind of does it. Like guessing it manually, you still wouldn't be able to do if you used it for a Bitcoin phrase. But once you know the vulnerabilities there, you can then hunt it down. But I'm going to tell you what I didn't cover when this happened in the beginning. Some, because I didn't know it, because I never used cold card, because I have a rule for devices like this, and it's why I like Trezor. And yes, I know they had an address list leaked, which is just like a customer list, and that's terrible. And it was their third-party fulfillment vendor that did it, and that didn't compromise your device. I'm talking about the device, right? It is a true open-source code, which means the best people on the planet when it comes to code are using it, grabbing it, using it as their homework, using it to build other tools, pulling on it, picking apart it, and they find vulnerabilities that way. And that's why a true open source, especially in this type of device, is more important, because since people are doing it. Now, what cold card had was like a pseudo open source. Hey, here's the code, can't use it without a license. Well, that means less people are going to pull on it, less people are going to do it, but it's worse than I thought. That was like, okay, that's their out. Since I first covered this, it has come out that many people had spotted the vulnerability and they told cold card. Several have screenshots they've posted on X, formerly Twitter, that shows them telling cold card about the vulnerability, and then a cold card immediately blocked them so they couldn't speak to them or comment on their shit anymore. This is malfeasance. The only reason that I don't think they'll be sued into oblivion is they're going to be in oblivion before they get sued. It's obscene. And so that's what happened. But what made it a vulnerability is once the vulnerability was identified, you could begin to sort of kind of think about the way that it worked is the best way I can put it. And they used AI tools to find the vulnerability, but standard hacking procedures to then hack afterwards, exploiting the vulnerability. Once you find one, then the pseudo random is not random at all anymore. And now it became predictable. That's how they were able to do it. So don't freak out. Now, here's some alternatives to, oh, my God, self-custody's not safe. I'm going to put all my money on Coinbase. Don't put it on Coinbase. All right? If you want to keep your Bitcoin on an exchange, use exchanges. Just like you would teach somebody with a high net wealth to keep their money in different bank accounts so that they have FDIC insurance. They don't go over the limits in each. So you might have two accounts instead of one. And you also have two bank accounts. So if something happens to one, you know, you still have the other. That would even be more true with exchanges. So you could spread it across exchanges. You also can have more than one hardware wallet, and they don't have to be the same make and model. So if there's an exploit in one, it's not in the other. So maybe you have two or three or four wallets. Maybe based on your net wealth and how much you hold, you say for every $20,000 worth of Bitcoin, you know, at least at current pricing, I'm going to have a hardware wallet. When I go over that, I'm going to have a different one. Some people might do that every year or 2 years. It makes it also an easy way to kind of keep your UTXOs separated. That's more to keep track of, but it's also having, you know, 520s instead of 100. If you lose the 100, you're broke. If you lose one of the 20s, you still have $80. You also could take the approach of, I'm going to keep some of my Bitcoin in exchange A, some of my Bitcoin on exchange B, and I'm going to keep a third of my Bitcoin on a Trezor. Like, you could do that. There's a lot. This is not what I'm saying. This is more like a dimmer switch than an on-off switch. You can think about all these different ways without getting into like multi-sig and these complex, you know, two devices and passphrases and hidden wallets and all. You can just simply break it up into chunks. And if you do that, what I would recommend is then you take like an exchange that is outside of the United States, an exchange that is inside the United States, and then a good quality hardware wallet and do a third into each. That would be another way to do it. Because the odds that, like, if the government were to come out and try to seize your assets, that they would be able to get to all the exchanges at the same time, and that gives you time to liquidate, right? There's a lot of different ways you can do this. I prefer full self-custody, but it's up to you how you do it, and I wouldn't give up self-custody itself only for the security of having customer support, et cetera, on exchange. If nothing else, do a 50-50. That I'm okay with. Now, I'm going to hear from somebody, but Jack, I only have $800. I don't care. If you have $800, I don't care what you do. It doesn't matter. Yeah, if you have $800, get Exodus, Electium, or a software wallet for free and self-custody that way, which is another option, right? You can have a hardware wallet. You can have a software wallet, but it's not connected to the hardware wallet, right? And then you got two different places that you're self-custody. Gold standard is the hardware wallet, but it's still damn secure in the software wallet. So I've got a software wallet, I got a hardware wallet, and I got an exchange account. I break it up whatever percentage I want to. Just be creative with it. Don't get over your skis and make sure you have backup information for everything you need to know to get your Bitcoin back if you lose the wallet with your passphrase or log into your account if that happens. All right, moving on. Let's talk about Tomahawks with Patrick Horman.
Hey guys, Patrick here with MT Knives, coming to you today with today's expert counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Roger. Roger asks, Tomahawk, could you have someone on your expert counsel talk about the best reasonably priced throwing fighting utility Tomahawk to add to your EDC? Well, I'm going to answer this question kind of the best I can. I don't have a wide broad experience with Tomahawks. I have some hatchets and some axes, but particular Tomahawks. I've used some, but I haven't tested a bunch of Tomahawks. So when you ask like the best, what's reasonably priced, my first thought goes to something like Cold Steel. Now, Cold Steel makes really affordable stuff. It's kind of, you know, okay quality, but they have some Tomahawks. They got quite a few Tomahawks to select from. I asked one of my friends, David, what he uses, and he's got a Cold Steel Tomahawk that he keeps in his car for EDC use. He said he's on a second one. He wore out the first one. But, you know, they're not real expensive, so not a big deal. Pick up something like that. The one he has has got a axe on one side and hammer on the other. So that could really come into handy if you need to hammer something in or do something like that. I particularly like the tomahawks for throwing that have the handles that can, they're tapered, and sometimes they'll get dislodged. The head will get dislodged, but you can just simply tap the handle back through. It's kind of wedged from the top. That way there's no chance of the head flying off the tomahawk because it's kind of wedge-shaped. The handle goes on from the bottom to the top so that it's not going to come off of there. The danger of some tomahawks, they're mounted a lot like your hammers where they're put the handles attached and wedged into place. And a lot of times those heads can get loose, especially if you're going to be throwing them. And so you have the danger of the head possibly flying off of the tomahawk. So I wouldn't recommend anything like that if you're going to be throwing it or using it for that kind of stuff. I've off and on over the years enjoyed throwing knives or tomahawks. And it's a fun thing to do with the family. It's just a fun pastime. I wouldn't ever, I think people, you never want to throw a weapon, but I shouldn't say never. It should be one of the last things that you do. The good thing about throwing stuff is you have space, you can keep distance. The bad thing is once you throw it, it's gone, and it could be used against you. So cold steel, I would recommend the cold steel. Also, I have seen, like, CRKT makes kind of stuff. You got your traditional style, like tomahawks, and then you got some of these new modern ones where, like, it's all one piece of steel with a handle attached. I think they could have their place. The question is are you looking for durability? Are you looking for affordability? Some of these tomahawks are going to get up, 100, 150 or more. If money was no object, there is a knife maker, Winkler Knives, and he makes a tomahawk or a, like, war hatchet. It's a breaching tool. He makes a lot of stuff like that for the military, for gaining entry and all sorts of stuff. So, like, if you're looking for something that's really battle-tested, if you want to use that term, then I would look at Winkler Knives, some of his stuff. Anyways, I think that pretty much covers that question as best I can. Hopefully it's helpful, and I will try to throw some links to Jack so that you guys can have some links in the show notes. And if there's any other questions, send them to me, patrick@mtknives.net, or send them to Jack. I thank you for the question, and we'll see you next time. This is Patrick with MT Knives. Stay sharp.
So my additions here are, number one, I think the problem we got out of the cold card debacle, if you want to call it that, is that it created an undue amount of panic among people because it was supposedly so secure, and it was supposedly so secure because it was a completely air-gapped device, which actually leads to why it became a compromised device. Though it was only a certain window of cold cards that had the problem, and some had it worse than others and were more susceptible than others. If you're using any cold card device, still, I would get your money off of it. I don't care when it's from or what they say. I would not trust people that made that mistake with my money ever again. Okay. But the reality is that the device itself caused the problem in the generation of the seed that made the seed not as random as we thought. And it is because there was a kind of a fallback loop in the code. So it was supposed to generate a random number, which can be backed up then, which is basically a phrase, right? So when you have that phrase and it's like dog, elephant, auto, car, monkey, dog poop, whatever the words are, those words actually represent numbers, right? That's what they really are. And so what happened with that device was the true random number generator failed, so it defaulted to a pseudo random number generator. And that's like, that sounds like a conspiracy. But what it really is there's a lot of processing in your computer that needs random generation, but it doesn't need to be super secure. You know, it might be something like a moving screensaver needs some randomness added to it so it doesn't look like a pattern. Just something that simple. So there is this pseudo random number generator, which sort of kind of does it. Like guessing it manually, you still wouldn't be able to do if you used it for a Bitcoin phrase. But once you know the vulnerabilities there, you can then hunt it down. But I'm going to tell you what I didn't cover when this happened in the beginning. Some because I didn't know it, because I never used Cold Card, because I have a rule for devices like this, and it's why I like Trezor. And yes, I know they had an address list leaked, which is just like a customer list, and that's terrible. And it was their third-party fulfillment vendor that did it, and that didn't compromise your device. I'm talking about the device, right? It is a true open-source code, which means the best people on the planet when it comes to code are using it, grabbing it, using it as their homework, using it to build other tools, pulling on it, picking apart it, and they find vulnerabilities that way. And that's why a true open source, especially in this type of device, is more important, because since people are doing it. Now, what Cold Card had was like a pseudo open source. Hey, here's the code. Can't use it without a license. Well, that means less people are going to pull on it. Less people are going to do it. But it's worse than I thought. That was like, okay, that's their out. Since I first covered this, it has come out that many people had spotted the vulnerability and they told Cold Card. Several have screenshots they've posted on X, formerly Twitter, that shows them telling Cold Card about the vulnerability, and then a Cold Card immediately blocked them so they couldn't speak to them or comment on their shit anymore. This is malfeasance. The only thing, the only reason that I don't think they'll be sued into oblivion is they're going to be in oblivion before they get sued. It's obscene. And so that's what happened. But what made it a vulnerability is once the vulnerability was identified, you could begin to sort of kind of think about the way that it worked is the best way I can put it. And they used AI tools to find the vulnerability, but standard hacking procedures to then hack afterwards, exploiting the vulnerability. Once you find one, then the pseudo random is not random at all anymore. And now it became predictable. That's how they were able to do it. So don't freak out. Now, here's some alternatives to, oh my God, self-custody is not safe. I'm going to put all my money on Coinbase. Don't put it on Coinbase, all right? If you want to keep your Bitcoin on an exchange, use exchanges. Just like you would teach somebody with a high net wealth to keep their money in different bank accounts so that they have FDIC insurance, they don't go over the limits in each, so you might have two accounts instead of one. And you also have two bank accounts, so if something happens to one, you know, you still have the other. That would even be more true with exchanges, so you could spread it across exchanges. You also can have more than one hardware wallet, and they don't have to be the same make and model. So if there's an exploit in one, it's not in the other. So maybe you have two or three or four wallets. Maybe based on your net wealth and how much you hold, you say for every $20,000 worth of Bitcoin, you know, at least at current pricing, I'm going to have a hardware wallet. When I go over that, I'm going to have a different one. Some people might do that every year or 2 years. It makes it also an easy way to kind of keep your UTXOs separated. That's more to keep track of, but it's also having, you know, 520s instead of 100. If you lose the 100, you're broke. If you lose one of the 20s, you still have 80 bucks. You also could take the approach of, I'm going to keep some of my Bitcoin in exchange A, some of my Bitcoin on exchange B, and I'm going to keep a third of my my Bitcoin on a Trezor. Like, you could do that. There's a lot. This is not what I'm saying. This is more like a dimmer switch than an on-off switch. You can think about all these different ways without getting into like multi-sig and these complex, you know, two devices and passphrases and hidden wallets and all. You can just simply break it up into chunks. And if you do that, what I would recommend is then you take like an exchange that is outside of the United States, an exchange that is inside the United States, and then a good quality hardware wallet, and do a third into each. That would be another way to do it. Because the odds that, like, if the government were to come out and try to seize your assets, that they would be able to get to all the exchanges at all the at the same time, and that gives you time to liquidate, right? There's a lot of different ways you can do this. I prefer full self-custody, but it's up to you how you do it. And I wouldn't give up self-custody itself only for the security of having customer support, et cetera, on exchange. If nothing else, do it 50-50. That I'm okay with. Now, I'm going to hear from somebody, but Jack, I only have $800. I don't care. If you have $800, I don't care what you do. It doesn't matter. Yeah, if you have $800, get Exodus, Electium, or some a software wallet for free and self-custody that way, which is another option, right? You can have a hardware wallet. You can have a software wallet, but it's not connected to the hardware wallet, right? And then you got two different places of your self-custody. Gold standard is the hardware wallet, but it's still damn secure in the software wallet. So I've got a software wallet, I got a hardware wallet, and I got an exchange account. I break it up whatever percentage I want to. Just be creative with it. Don't get over your skis and make sure you have backup information for everything you need to know to get your Bitcoin back if you lose the wallet with your passphrase or log into your account if that happens. All right, moving on. Let's talk about Tomahawks with Patrick Horman.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from the homesteadconsultant.com. Today I have a question on EV rapid shutdown systems and what they do. So I'll read the question and a little bit of the details and we'll dive right in. The question is, how does a PV rapid shutdown system work, and what considerations should one make when determining to invest in one for a new install? There are quite a few details here, but the basic details are that the panels are going to be going on a barn roof, and that there is not going to be any permitting on this install. Additionally, the rapid shutdown system will cost about add about a 20% cost onto the entire solar electric system. So there's really four questions that need to be answered. One, what is PV rapid shutdown system? Two, how does it work? Three, when do you need it? And four, when do you not need it? So let's start on the first one. What is a rapid shutdown system? So to answer that, you really need to understand how a solar panel works, or I should say how series solar panels work, meaning if you hook up one solar panel to the next, negative to positive, etc., you will increase the voltage of those panels without increasing the amperage. So if I had a 30-volt panel and another 30-volt panel, and I hook them in series together, I would then have 60 volts. Let's say those panels were 5 amps. I'd have 60 volts at 5 amps instead of 30 volts at 5 amps. So I can increase the voltage without increasing the amperage, meaning I can move twice the amount of power across the same sized line. This is really beneficial, but it creates a problem because as we add more and more of those panels in series, you get a higher and higher voltage. High voltage DC can be especially dangerous. With AC, there's an alternating current, meaning that if you touch it every, let's see, it's 60 times per second, it alternates from positive to negative. It's not technically right, but, you know, for the sake of illustration. And so if you touch it, your muscles have more of a potential to let go. The shock is typically less, things like that. It just interacts with the body differently. And so when you've got these panels in series and you've got a roofing system, and let's say emergency responders need to get in through the roof or need to interact somewhere where there's wiring from these panels, you've got high voltage DC, oftentimes in the realm of 450 volts, that they're going to have to work around. The idea of a rapid shutdown system is in a dwelling where people are living, the emergency responders are going to be able to hit a button and shut those panels down. Now, the panels themselves don't actually shut down. What it does is disconnects the panels from each other. And so the NEC code requires, I believe it's a 30 volt, for the system to be able to drop down to 30 volts within 30 seconds of when that button is pressed. That means that there shouldn't be more than 30 volts outputting anywhere in the system, meaning your panels are supposed to be 30 volts or below. So this is just like the NEC regulations that are code that requires main breakers on the exterior of homes for homes that are connected to the grid. This allows them to rapidly shut off the power to the home. This is the same idea, but for solar. So with rapid shutdown, you actually have a device sitting between each solar panel in the series, and then there's a transmitter that's highly accessible on the side of the building where a button can be pressed. Transmitter shuts down the connection between all of the panels, and therefore you've reduced the voltage down to 30 volts. So now you know what it is. The NEC appears to, in my general overview of it, be saying that that should be installed anytime your panels are on a building. I would, if you're doing this off-grid or unpermitted, you realistically, a building like a barn that you're building these on, you may be risking potential to for yourself to be able to get in there during a fire or something, but you really probably wouldn't want to anyway. So just keep in mind that the real safety risk or the issue here is primarily dealing with dwellings, places where people are going to be living or sleeping, where emergency responders may need to get in a fire or other emergency. Keep in mind, if you install panels on top of a building that is a dwelling or somewhere where somebody lives, or another building, because of the NEC, you do have the possibility of violating some portion of homeowner's insurance or something like that. I don't know if that's fully true. I've done a bit of digging, and it looks like some insurance policies may take that into consideration. So just keep that in mind, and if there's any insurance brokers out there who know whether or not the rapid shutdown system is required for getting proper coverage if you do have a fire, let me know. I'd be really curious. So my overall personal thoughts on when it's needed is when it's going to be on a dwelling. It's recommended, and the NEC, I think, requires it basically on any building. But if you're dealing with something like a barn or a carport or a lean-to or something that is not connected directly to a dwelling, I'd be less concerned or worried about it. So great question. I hope that answers what you were asking and gives you kind of a groundwork for it. You can look up the information on the NEC or National Electric Code to see if you feel that the requirements are warranted for your given situation. But I hope that gives you kind of an overview of what the reason for the rapid shutdown system is. All right, that's it for me. If anybody has questions they want me to answer regarding any of these, you know, kind of technical things on the homestead or any homestead question for that matter, send those out to Jack and I'll get them answered. Thanks, everyone.
So great stuff from Ryan. I also think it's kind of a case for, as you're putting in backup power systems, once you go over kind of a certain size system and you're powering, you know, most of or all of your home, if you're moving in that direction, it's probably a good idea, even if you do a lot of the work yourself to save money, that you involve a professional to aid you with making decisions on things like this. Because, oh, it's 21% cost, but it might save the 80% from frying itself, right? So sometimes those are really, it's one of those things like, it's a hard pill to swallow, but once you swallow it, you're glad that you did. Buy once, cry once type of thing. All right, so now let's move on to my topic today. I want to talk to you about, you know, there's an old quote, and I'll just read you the old quote, but I just think it's more true today than it ever was. The quote is from Robert Heinlein, and he said, "A human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects." And it's been, that's been around a while. It's barely younger than me. It was born, that quote was born in 1973. So again, it's been around a while. So this is not a new idea. And as I mentioned during kind of my lead up on today's show, the intro, you know, this actually fits very well with what Ben Franklin said about being a jack of all trades and a master of none. And I promise you, you can go back into things like the writings of the Stoics. So now we're talking thousands of years ago and find much of the same advice. So this is not a brand new thing. However, throughout history, there have been certain times where it is more true than other times. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, something can be always true, but the importance and relevance and impact of it because of the situation on the ground is more true. Make it brutally honest, it's always true that you should always be prepared to be attacked. You can't stay at a heightened state of alert at all times, though, but it is more true that you should be ready for an attack when things are going on around you that indicate you might be attacked than when everything's peaceful, right? And such that not just that it's more likely, but it's harder to know when it's coming. When things are relatively peaceful, maybe you expect an attack less. But when something's out of place in the peaceful situation, it's more obvious. Yeah? Where when everything's chaotic and attacks are happening everywhere, like, is that really an attack? It's just more chaos. That's where we're at with the concept of being a polymath. Now, if you haven't ever heard the term before, you must be new around here. But a polymath is simply somebody who is really good at a lot of things. So good at the things that if they needed to, they could do the thing as a profession, right? They're competent enough to teach it, and they're competent enough to use it when something is in front of them. Even if they couldn't, like if they're, you say like they have a mechanical aptitude and they know how to work on a car, even if they don't have all the skill set to walk in and become like a level 3 technician or something at a dealership, they have enough base knowledge that if they went in there and did that for a few weeks or months, they would be as good as anybody on the floor, except maybe the very top guy. But that same person could walk in to a data entry position or a marketing analyst position, or they could go be a fishing guide on a river, or they can take care of horses, or they can, you know, farm. And it doesn't have to be all the things. It just has to be a lot of things and a lot of fluidity and moving in between them. And this is something that, like, I was a polymath before I knew the word polymath, because I'm curious and I'm interested in things. Right. I actually do some small amount of what we call affirmations every morning. And one of mine is to maintain curiosity and wonder. And that's not something that I used to do in that little part of my morning practice, because I didn't need to, because I was young and it was natural. As I've aged, those things that I reinforce in my life have to change with me. And the older we get, the more set in our ways we become. And I became consciously aware of this, you know, probably 5 to 10 years before I started the podcast, that this is what I'm really doing. This is who I really am. And this is why this is important. And this is why I've always been this way. And this is why people say you lack focus. It's not that I lack focus. I like to focus on a lot of things. I don't get laser on anything unless it's really, really important to the situation. And what that has taught me is that the more you know about a lot of things, the more you can understand any one thing. It's pattern recognition. And that becomes even more important when the times are like they are today and you are evolving into things that weren't here before. There isn't anybody to go really learn from. And if you are learning from somebody, they're just somebody that's been more interested in it for like the past year than you, because it's only been around a year or two or three. AI is a perfect example of this. The AI that we know today did exist before 2023, but in a way that was accessible to everybody. The way that we use it today, the way that people are using Grok, the way that people use ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, etc., in that LLM, very friendly model, really came on the scene in 2023. Now, it probably feels like, man, this has been here with us forever, but 3 years. Who's really a master of anything that's only existed for 3 years? Who has 10,000 hours on something that's only existed for 3 years? You see what I'm saying? Or cryptocurrency with Bitcoin. 2007, the idea for something like a Bitcoin exists, but a Bitcoin doesn't exist. Look at all the tech that's developed on its back in what, 18 years? 18 years? And I mean, let's not just talk about Bitcoin itself and all the advances in mining, but all the layered technologies. And when you look at somebody like a Michael Saylor that people have hatred for because he doesn't use Bitcoin the way I say he should. Bitcoin's for everybody. Bitcoin's money. I don't like the way you're using it. That doesn't work. But the investment vehicles that you see he's built, like Stretch, right? This basically fixed income instrument that pays out interest rates around 10% on average, and the interest itself until you recoup your entire investment is tax-free. That is an application of a former investment scheme into a new technology that at the time he did it, you know, was already 16, 17 years old, but no one else had ever even, not just not done it, never even thought to do it. I've got something that easily conservatively returns a 20% ROI. I can pay 10% on it, and I can acquire as much of it as possible. Basic mindset. It's not like this has never been done with a financial instrument before, but it had to be adapted to a new technology and a new regulatory environment, right? Talk about opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Look at food. Look at what Nick and I talked about yesterday. What was the solution if you wanted to eat more T-bones and ribeyes 20 years ago? Work harder, make more money, buy all the beef you want. Don't worry about it. We have to get creative now. Whether that involves simply learning to break down primals, a skill, raise your own cattle, a skill, putting together a cow share co-op type thing that's really an LLC, because the co-op legally doesn't work for it, and organizing your neighbors so that there's one rancher that is growing cattle locally for you, and you all have ownership so the government can go take a hike, that's a different skill set. That's a different skill set. When you look at the cost of food, growing your own food, there's 100 ways to do it. We talk about aquatics. We talk about aquaponics. We talk about hydroponics. We talk about basic organic garden. We talk about full-scale permaculture. All these are different ways. Some people are not going to want to do all that, but maybe what they can do is a small container garden with some of their fruiting crops, like some tomatoes, some eggplants, some peppers, but really focus on growing out like leafy greens if they eat that. And herbs, fresh herbs, are extremely expensive. And the more you have, the more you'll use, and the more quality you get out of them. That's another skill. Like, look around your life and think about all the things you know how to do. Think about all the things you know how to do really well. I know how to fish really well. That means I'm not going to go hungry. That's what it means. It means I'm not going to go hungry. I might not be sitting down to red snapper or Chilean sea bass every night, but I'm going to eat. You give me 50 cents worth of shit, and I can go get enough fish for a meal for the night. I mean, that's a skill. It has a direct application. But now you're sitting in flux, like major flux. It's hard to even understand what's going on right now. But I promise you, if you had gone, let's say, to jail, right, prison, about 2018, and, you know, you're in a deep, well, you're just trying to stay alive. So you're really, even with some of the data coming in and out of the prison system, you have no real understanding of what's changed in 8 years. Just 8 years. And somebody put you back on the street right now, especially if, like, you went back to a completely normal life. Hey, man, we screwed up and you didn't belong here in the first place. And the state did what it's supposed to do in that situation, compensated you for your time because they illegally put you away. And so you're financially okay, so you can go back to a nice house, you can have a computer, you can fire it up, you can have a conversation with ChatGPT. You can jump on the internet, you can find out all the things that you want to find out. And you also can get a job, and they tell you, hey, you're going to make, you know, $75,000 a year. You're like, whoa, this is better than when I went in. I'm going to be fine. And then what? You go to the grocery store, right? And just think about all of the things that we have today that we didn't have just 8 years ago. Now do it over 20. Now do it over 20. Go back to 2006 and look at the world today versus the last 20 years. Now understand that what I've been saying for a long, since 2008, I've been saying this is a 10-year period, a decade of flux coming that will be to the extreme. And back in 08 when I started the show, my numbers were off by 5 years. I said 2020 to 2030. And I honestly believe had COVID not come when it did, I would have been right. That whole thing just pushed the timeline out 5 years. And now that I'm sitting here looking at it, I'm going, this is exactly what I meant. Did I know the exact things? No, but I knew this was coming. You simply can no longer be a specialist only. And I don't even think you can afford to be a specialist in one thing only. I think you need to be a specialist at 2 to 3 things. And that will make you at least highly competent in about 3 per each. So now you're at 12. You got the 3 cores, and then you got your 3x3 offshoots, right? No. That's 12, right? You need to have that kind of competence, and that's just with the things that are marketable and professional, right? Even if you haven't done them professionally, you could say you have. Anyways, not if you haven't, one of them needs to be how to write a resume accurately. Well, this is only 10% of what I do, but the job you're applying for is 80% the thing you do 10% of. That's the only thing that you need to market about what you did. Or you need to make, you need to invert it. You need to make like the 10% is the 90% and everything else you did was like the 10% to support it, right? At least get in front of the person. But then you need like dozens of other pieces of knowledge. What you need to be is the kind of person that can sit down and look at a situation and go, I don't know anything about this, but I can take 10 minutes and begin to understand it. And as soon as I begin to understand it, I can say this thing I'm looking at, the situation I'm looking like at is similar to these other two situations. It's not identical, but it's similar. And because it's similar, I can infer that if A does B and C does D, then E probably does F. Do you see what I'm saying? And that comes from hands-on, direct gaining of knowledge of many, many different things. And then what that does for the person that everybody says has ADD, it turns it into a superpower. Because basically what ends up happening, if you can get yourself into this state mentally, you become very excited about the thing. You learn as much as you can about the thing. And it's like, it's not that you just throw it away, like yeet it out like the baby with the bathwater. It's just that, okay, I learned that. And now whenever I need that, I'm going to use that, and whether I'm directly applying it or I'm drawing on it for pattern recognition. And I'm going to go learn another thing. And I learned that, and I'm going to go learn another thing. And maybe sometimes you're learning two things simultaneously. It is that approach that builds a polymath. I think people think because the well-known names here, right, like a Leonardo da Vinci, a Benjamin Franklin, though I think Franklin gets way more credit as a polymath than maybe he deserves because writing about a thing and doing a thing are different. Isaac Newton, Aristotle, right? Like, but they all had this commonality, right? Like deep curiosity, connecting ideas and deliberate practice. But because they are known as pure geniuses, because their names survive through history, we think to be a polymath, I have to be a Da Vinci, and I ain't no Da Vinci, right? All right, I'm a martial artist. And most people would say, okay, like I have no problem with that. And if a person has studied martial arts, you know, you didn't take 2 weeks at the YMCA. Like you put time in, you trained, you practiced, you sparred, you got your bumps and bruises and lumps, you know, you put in the effort, you at least gained a few belts, right? You fought for the knowledge, and you acquired the knowledge, you put it into practice, and you trained. You're a martial artist, right? Okay, you're not Bruce Lee, right? You're not Chuck Norris. You're not Gracie, right? You're not any of these people, okay? And so you don't have to be, like, the best known of the thing to be the thing. I'm a permaculturist. I have no qualms saying I'm a permaculturist. I ain't Jeff Lawton. I ain't Bill Mollison. Right? I ain't even David Holmgren. I'm a damn good car driver with the limitation of, you know, I can't see out of one eye. But I can do some pretty cool shit with a car. I ain't, you know, Bill Elliott or Dale Earnhardt or Kyle Petty or whoever the hell is famous now. You know, Richard Petty back in the day or whatever. I'm not those. Still a good driver. And so you don't have to be a Da Vinci. You don't have to be a Newton or a Franklin to be a polymath. You just have to have the core concepts, which again is a deep curiosity, the ability to connect ideas, and deliberate practice. You have to actually do the thing that you say you want to know on some level. Now, some things are soft skills, so you don't have to like get in the ring, so to say, to learn a soft skill, but you have to actually put it to work. If you want to say you one of the things you are is a good communicator, well, you better have communicated in a way that mattered, either verbally or in written communication. If you want to say that you are an artist, well, then you better paint or draw or whatever. And again, you don't have to do all the things. Am I a polymath? Yes. Does that mean I'm a good artist? No. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler, right? I'm really not good. I just am not. Right, because I don't have that meticulous attention to detail, and it probably doesn't help to be blind in one eye. I'm not sure that's why, but I can't believe it's helpful. But I think that, and maybe it's time to do another whole show on this topic, because I know I've done it in the past, on being a polymath. but specifically angled to its importance in the modern days. I just want you to think about it this way. What can you learn that you know very little about in the next 30 days? What can you learn how to do that you do not know how to do right now, that 30 days from now, maybe you're not an expert at it, but you're competent in it. Now I can do the thing, right? And that could be making a knife. That could be learning how to put a good finish on a gun stock. It can even be a piece of something that you already know how to do other things in, but you don't have to do the one thing in. You know, if you like guns, do you know how to do a good trigger job? Not just slap a Timmy trigger in, right? Or do you know how to float a barrel, right? If you don't, there's no shame in it, but, and I'm not saying you should go learn to do it. I'm saying it's anything you could learn to do. Do you know how to do you know how to reload, right? Like, that is a skill. If you are into gardening, but you've never started your own plants, learn how to start your own plants. If you garden, but you buy in your compost, learn how to make good compost. If you already know how to make good compost with worm composting and maybe bioreactor composting, maybe you take up and say, I'm going to learn how to do black soldier flies this time, and now I'm also producing feed for my birds, assuming you have birds. If you don't have birds, but you do garden, there's other uses for the soldier fly larva. You can monetize them. There's other people that want them, right? There's a like, that's just inside composting. I hope you get what I'm saying. Broaden your horizons and broaden your skill set. Start to look at what you're able to do, what you know how to do, and what you already know that lets you figure out things you don't know when you see a new situation, like arrows in a quiver. And then you're like, just when I talk about Bitcoin, and I try to make it really simple. I say, look, the simple way to understand this, don't try to time the market. Don't be talking about backing up a truck full of money when you don't have a truck or the money, right? Don't be thinking you need to time everything. End every day with more sats than you started with. Stay humble, stack sats. Done. Just do that and let that go on autopilot. Go on and do other things in your life, right? So the sats are now like the arrows in the quiver. And you can't learn maybe a full skill every day. But you want to learn something to advance toward having another arrow in the quiver every day. And maybe you're putting an arrow in the quiver once a month. Some months are maybe good months and you're doing two. And so you get to the end of a year and now you have 12 or 18 skills, legitimate skills and knowledge bases that you didn't start the year with. And you do that for, you know, half a lifetime. Now you're in your 40s if you're a young buck, and you're still going for another 30 years, maybe 20 years. Not only will you be more resilient, not only will your life be more financially advantageous, right, but your life's more interesting. And I find that when I kind of complete something and I don't right away find something to do, I'm almost a little bit depressed. Like, I'm not motivated now. Like, the idea of me ever fully retiring is kind of foreign to me. I tried to go down a 3-day work week. I'm like, I can't do this. I didn't come back for money. Make the same money 3 days or 4 days. Doesn't change anything. Like, my life started to just feel like, what am I doing? Like, this is the thing I love. I should be doing the thing I love, and it lets me go into all these different disciplines. You find that, you're unstoppable. You find that, not only are you unstoppable, but you are so highly adaptable that even when the entire ground shifts underneath you, you're just on a surfboard. You just transition. You do something differently. Become a polymath. Because you're going to need to be one over the next 10 years. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. I want to remind you about a couple things. One, again, on September the 19th, that's a Saturday morning, the workshop, the TSP 26 workshop, goes on sale. Definitely tune in Monday. I'm going to tell you a lot more about some of the things that will be going on there, some really new, unique, and cool things. I need to have some conversations over the weekend with a few people to confirm some stuff. If you're not a member of my members program known as the MSB or Member Support Brigade, please consider becoming one. It is the easiest way in the world to get more money in your pocket. You give me $50, I give you discounts on stuff you're buying anyway. You save $150, $200 over the next year. That's $100 to $150 in your pocket. And you support the show. So consider doing it. Just go to the survivalpodcast.com/members to learn more. Do your online shopping at tspaz.com. The recommendations I have there are all products I own and use, spent my money on, or I wouldn't recommend them to you. You're helping me when you shop there, whether you buy what I recommend or not. and all you have to do is start your online shopping there. It literally doesn't cost you anything but maybe an extra 5 seconds to do it that way. I do get questions sometimes. If I'm on my phone and I go to T-Spaz and I click the link and go over to Amazon and the Amazon app opens, do you get credit? Yes. Yes, we do, as far as we're supposed to. Maybe it doesn't always work, but it's the best that you can do. And last but not least, while you're on Amazon, look up Laws of Life and pick up a copy of Laws of Life Book 1 and Book 2. Or if you already have one, pick up the other one. Check them out. The new hardcovers are really, really great. Much better experience. Check them out. And again, I hope you guys all have a great weekend. Stay curious. Stay full of curiosity and wonder. Keep learning something new every day, and what you'll find is you'll be a lot more excited to get up on a daily basis. You'll be a lot more excited by the time the day ends about the next day that comes, and your life will just be a little bit better that way, because that's what we're all about here, helping you live a better life. Times get tough, or if they don't.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.